it anyway. So I'm hoping that we understand that we live in a time that where you're looking, that's why when we were talking with Drew, they'd been up to the Axiom Conference up in Salt Lake City, all these young people and different rights organizations there. And the biggest thing is you only get, you know, a couple hundred people go to this thing, which is fine. You know, because a lot of the people, they were the activists. They were sharing with each other. I've been to these things. Heck, we do the Freedom Summit. Comes up the first weekend this December. Go to freedomsummit.com. You'll see a lot of great speakers. You know, we pretty much got it done. We'll start promoting it heavy here pretty quick. But I just want to make sure you understand the power of us just understanding what's going on so as individuals we don't fall right into the trap. And if you were taught anything in government schools, which, of course, that's the last place you're going to hear anything like this, about what the proper role of government is, how you should organize your finances, what is and is not moral behavior, what's right, what's wrong, if you're able to do that, you pretty much can insulate yourself from a lot of bad decisions just by listening to what Grandma had to say. Yeah, everything you need to know you learned in kindergarten. Yep. Well, we'll go over some of the headlines in the news today. There's some things I want to talk to you about. Looks like Newsweek is, you know, got saved a little bit, but lamestream media is going away.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Oh, the times, they are a-changing.
Yeah, they sure are. But a lot of us have been predicting what was going to happen. You know, this is, I'll give you an example. There's some news that's coming out in the last day or two that, you know, really kind of tells you where the future is going. Newsweek is a property of the Washington Post. It's, plummeting like a stone in its values and its debt. I mean, it's got $15 million a year rent, you know, in New York. It's got enormous overhead. It's the second largest publication, weekly publication behind Time. So what happened with Newsweek is that you had an icon, you know, and it's just more propaganda into the matrix kind of crap. You know, I can't stand it. You know, I fly a lot and going around speaking and so on. And I always go to the Borders Books thing at the airport and I'll grab some science magazines or something to see what's on there. And you're deluged with the cover art for each of these news magazines, you know, U.S. News and World Report or Time or Newsweek, and I didn't know what happened to the U.S. News and World Report. I don't see it much anymore. Maybe it went away. And what happens is you get whatever the propaganda in the cover, what value does it have to have shelf space at the front? You know, it's that has value just to promote whatever the heck it is that what's the headline. How much is that worth to have it every single news outlet, every grocery store, every 7-Eleven, every Circle K, every airport, book, newspaper stand? You'll have Newsweek had, you know, here's the injection. There was a movie that was called They Live. And I remember it was a, you know, B science fiction thing, but it was really clever. And one of the things, it was subliminal messages. And if you put on these right kind of sunglasses, all of a sudden you saw all the magazines. All they said was obey, you know, consume, you know, do whatever the heck it is that they wanted. And it was just kind of a, you know, play on, you know, you're just being programmed. Well, Newsweek, it's going out. It's ready to wink out. So here we have a gentleman named Sidney Harmon that comes in and buys it for a dollar. He goes, here's your dollar. Well, he took on all the liability for it, too. Well, a lot of the people that are working there are like, yay, at least we got a job. We're gonna instead of just closing up shop, we have Newsweek is going to continue to be published. Why? Is there something that Sidney wants to say? He's 91 years old. All right, you know, he was born in 1918. You know, he made his money being in, you know, radio, you know, and sound and so on. He did had a career doing that. But what a lot of people don't know, they're not making a big enough deal out of, in my mind, is he's married to Jane Harmon. Jane Harmon is California's 36th Congressional District House Representatives. She's the second richest member of the House. Over $160 million in assets that we know of. Now, the richest guy is some Republican named Daryl Issa, who represents a congressional district in California. So she went from, after graduating from law school back in the late 60s, she began her political career in Washington, D.C., serving as chief counsel and staff director to the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights. In Washington, yeah, okay. She served in that position until moving over to the executive branch of government, serving as a special counsel to the Department of Defense. Okay, and as Deputy Secretary of the Cabinet, both positions in the Carter administration, she held a brief teaching position at UCLA, and then she went on to run for Congress. Well, she's not short of cash. And being an attorney for the Department of Defense, you would think she knows how the deck's stacked. You know, I mean, what, is anything a secret to her? Or the military-industrial complex is, you know, lost on her? So, you know, they got all kinds of different controversies here. I remember, you know, the AIPAC controversy in October 06. Time magazine quoted anonymous sources asserting that an FBI and U.S. Department of Justice investigation of Harmon was underway. The magazine alleged that Harmon had agreed to lobby for the Department of Justice to reduce espionage charges against Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman, two officials at the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. You remember that? In exchange, Times said that there was a quid pro quo in which AIPAC would lobby then-House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi to appoint Harman as chair of the House Intelligence Committee if the Democrats captured the House after the 2006 election. Harman, the FBI, the Justice Department, and Pelosi's office have all denied knowledge of or involvement with any investigation. AIPAC denied it and that it engaged in a quid pro quo with Harman. AIPAC would never engage in a quid pro quo in relation to a federal investigation or any federal matter, and the notion that it would do so is preposterous, a spokesman at the time said. So it goes on and on and on. But so what do you have here? You have an attorney that goes and works for the Senate Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights, you know, so I always feel better about that. And then she becomes an attorney for the Department of...
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Don't stop me now. I'm having such a good time. I'm having a ball. Don't stop me now. If you want to have a good time, just give me a call. Don't stop me now.
Yeah, just give me a call. 866-986-6397. All right, I'll let you guys go ahead and have that. Stephen Kinsella, he's advocating for no intellectual property rights. There is no such thing. It doesn't exist, and you've been duped. You know, you've been duped. Well, go ahead and let's go ahead and dwell on that just a little bit. We've talked about, Stephen, we've had the concept of property rights. You know, we agree that, you know, it's mine. I got to wrap my arms and legs around it's mine. Okay, we got property rights and a proper role, if you're going to have any government, is defense of property rights. You know, okay, we're all good on that. Then we got, you know, this patenting, copyrighting, trademarking of an idea, a concept. And, of course, the argument was is that that would propagate more innovation and invention and so on because they would financially benefit from it. Of course, back in the day, I'm sure there was someone that had an idea, an industry, and the big boys, and they wanted to protect against competition, somebody, you know, getting in on their gig. But we're looking at, can you really, in as a principled view of what is and is not the role of government to defend something that is somebody's, can you put a arms and legs around an idea? Should we? I mean, just the practicality of it. And as we have the ability to digitize information and software and music and video, and it's just getting to the point that it's kind of a moot point. They can't accomplish it anyway.
Correct. I agree with that. And I mean, let's think for a second. What would a principled defense of IP be? What would a principled approach be? I mean, would it be infinite terms? Because right now they're finite. Okay, almost every proponent of IP believes in some finite term, like a copyright should last 110, 120 years, 50 years, whatever.
And then change it later anyway.
Yeah, so in other words, either you believe in some finite term or you think they should last forever. Now, there are a couple of IP advocates like Galambos and I think even Spooner. They believed that they should be perpetual. Now, to me, that's insanity because that would mean by now we would all be paying royalties every time you did anything. If you flush the toilet, if you light a match, you know, you're going to pay royalties to some descendant of the original caveman who invented this or the original guy who invented the first toilet, whatever. I mean, it would basically ensnare all the world of action and we would be paralyzed and we would die. So that is why no one believes in infinite IP rights. So that means they believe in some term of patent rights and copyrights. Zero, not infinite. So what should it be? Should it be 50 years? Should it be 10 years? Should it be 5 years? How do they know? How do they know they're at the top of their curve, let's say?
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? See, if you can get down to the principle, then you don't have to worry about all these subjective decisions. Let's go ahead and go to the callers. Barry Hess from Arizona. Go ahead, man.
Hey, hi, Ernie, and I appreciate the conversation here tonight. I'll get right to it because I am a libertarian, and I'm not in total agreement. I really have some kind of difficulties in thinking that if we were to remove all patents and copyrights, we would also stymie any innovation and creativity or an incentive thereof, or, even more importantly, the ability for the artist or the creator to maintain their lifestyle, to derive some kind of pecuniary interest from it.
Stefan, let me go ahead and ask Barry a question.
Sure.
Is that the goal of any kind of a law or a philosophy or something, is to give them incentive? I mean, that was the thing that bothered me the most about Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution. To promote the sciences and arts, we're going to do fill-in-the-blank and have this patent stuff. And I'm going, since when was that the role of government, is to promote anything? You know, I'm just, you know, so that's what we're talking about here. We're trying to get down to the protection of property rights, and they call it intellectual property, which means that you can own an idea. I mean, so the question is, should you be able to own an idea, and what detrimental effect would that have, or positive effect would that have on society?
Well, I'm not sure that, you know, you cannot own your own idea, depending on, and that's, I didn't even want to get into that part of it.
Well, I mean, that's what it's all about. It's okay, all about owning an idea.
But you had asked about is providing an incentive. I think that the patent office should be restructured merely to protect, but then you run into all the conflagration that you guys have been talking about, perhaps with a little modification, like requiring there could not be a secret patent. And that very limited, we do have limited exclusivity at this time. But I would encourage the patent office to be restructured to, reflect that we allow free use of anything out there with an automatic compensation to the originator. And the only purpose the patent office should serve is simply to protect those rights along the same lines as they do for song artists and, you know.
Well, see, that's where we're getting. We're getting into copyright. And what's the difference, Stefan, between copyrights and trademarks and patents? Is it all kind of the same thing?
No, there's differences. Copyrights basically create creative, they protect creative expression, okay, like a song or artwork. And actually, it's automatic. If you write down something in an email or on a book, you instantly get copyright protection. And whether you want it or not, it's almost impossible to get rid of. Patents you have to apply for, and the term is a lot shorter. Now, there is this regulated scheme called ASCAP, which is even worse, okay, because the government comes in and dictates the royalties people get, which is, I think, what Barry's advocating we should have in the patent system. We should make the patent system more like copyright. But, I mean, look, Barry said a couple of things. Number one, he said that if we don't have these systems, if we get rid of them, then innovation would be stymied. Now, Barry, let me ask you, first of all, do you agree that the burden of proof is on anyone who advocates setting up this system in the first place, or is the burden of proof on us to advocate abolishing a government grant of privilege that Congress has enacted?
I don't know. I don't have a problem abandoning government altogether, but while it's there, I see that there could be some usefulness to it in protecting the rights, at least to the extent where an artist could survive. I mean, otherwise, you put one song on the internet, it's duplicated a million times, and poof, it's gone. I can empathize with some of the singers.
Better start selling some T-shirts.
Yeah.
Well, I would say this. I mean, first of all, when you say innovation is stymied, you cannot seriously argue that there would be no innovation. All you can argue is that there would be less innovation, that there wouldn't be enough innovation. So I would ask you, what is enough innovation? And how do you know we have enough? And how do you know we didn't have enough if we don't have IP law? And, you know, as a matter of fact, libertarians who argue exactly the same way literally have come out in favor of, I have one right here, Alexander Tabarrok, who's a libertarian, has argued in favor of an $80 billion tax-funded medical innovation prize fund to replace the patent system.
Whoa.
So, you know, so these guys think the patent monopoly doesn't give you enough of an incentive. So we should just go ahead and be honest about it, steal money from the taxpayers, and go ahead and give it directly to these innovators that the government committees think are brilliant enough to deserve.
Well, they're already doing it. NASA's got lunar landers that they want to do. It's kind of like the Ansari X Prize, which was private. And so NASA sees the benefit of civilian commercial space flight coming out, and they're going, well, hey, we'll do that, and we'll just rip off taxpayer and do it our way.
And in fact, there's a close connection between all these arguments for government research. I mean, how many times have you heard the stupid argument that if we didn't have the multi-billion dollar space program, we wouldn't have Tang? I mean, I'm so sick of this argument. It's ridiculous. I mean, let's say we wouldn't have Tang. Is Tang worth $100 billion or whatever the space program costs? You know, what did we not get that we would have gotten if that money had been privately invested?
Well, you raised some really good questions. You've got me thinking about it. This is a subject that comes up here and again, but it's not one that's ever discussed in depth. So, Ernie, I will let you guys get back to it. I'm enjoying the conversation. I didn't want to interrupt, but I was curious as to your thoughts on that, the idea of modifying it just as a registry.
Well, then you got to register, you know, intellectual property as intellect, as if thought, as if an idea can become property in equated with land or something. I'm just, you know, I understand it is a good subject. Are we able to keep you another segment, Stefan?
Absolutely.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. You've been very patient with us because this is something we're all very interested in, and we'll talk about it some more when we come back here on Declare Your Independence.
There are those that just want to be left alone and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Turn on the tube. What do I see? A whole lot of people crying. Don't blame me. They point the crooked little fingers at everybody else. Spend all the time feeling sorry for themselves. Victim of this. Victim of that. Your mama's too thin.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was distracted. I was reading. I shouldn't have been reading. You know, headphones off. We're back with Stefan Kinsella, KinsellaLaw.com, KinsellaLaw.com. Now, let's go ahead and discuss, you know, kind of what the solution is, because where we're at now is that we're at a point to where we would have to take patent, intellectual property, copyright, trademark, all of that, and just sweep it away. What would we be left with?
Well, I think, look, trademark is not as bad as patent and copyright. There are problems with it. Trade secret has problems, too. But the primary culprits here are copyright and patent. Not surprisingly, they're federal government creations primarily. Trademark and trade secret have their roots in the common law, and there are aspects of them that you could argue in favor of. Trademark can be based upon fraud. Trade secret could be based upon contract. And property rights and trespass, things like that. I think we have to point out to people that this is basically mercantilism. It's a privilege. The utilitarian arguments are flawed, and they haven't been satisfied.
But that's not a principled argument. I mean, you know, I really want to deal on a principled argument. Somebody would say, well, it would benefit us here based on what? I mean, based on whose determination of what is a benefit? The government? Yay. I want that. What? The church? Yay. I want them to do it. The schools? Yay. I mean, you know, there's no monopoly that I want to give any kind of power to tell me how I'm being benefited or not. So
let's look at it from a practical point of view. The primary arguments in favor of these things is that, you know, it helps, copyright helps spur artistic creation, right? And patents help spur innovation. Now, let's look at them for a second. What copyright really does in the real world, this is today, okay? Most authors, for example, of novels and books, they don't really make money from copyright. The publishers do, and the publishers reap a large part of it. So basically, and especially, let's say you have a long-dead author. I mean, their work is being suppressed because the work's out of print, no one can copy it, and the publisher's charging a lot of money for any remaining prints. So the publisher gets the benefit of that. Nowadays, you will see all these models being turned to by authors, even popular authors. They're just publishing it themselves. I mean, let's say an author makes $2 for a book, for a $20 book. The publisher gets the rest, and the rest is overhead for paper. I mean, an author who's well-known can just put up a file on Kindle, sell it for $3, let's say. He makes $3 almost pure profit, and no, there's no middleman. So there are ways around these things. Now, let's take patents. Most people are not aware of this, but most patents by independent inventors, let's say, are completely useless. They are just wallpaper. The guy spends $7,000, $8,000, $10,000, $20,000, get this piece of paper to brag to his friends or to, you know, but it does him no good whatsoever. Most companies that get patents, do you know why they get them? They get them for defensive purposes. They basically build up an armory of patents around themselves simply to assert against other big companies if they get sued as a patent infringement. So it's like a porcupine defense. So you have all these millions and millions of dollars being spent on patent attorney fees and patent office fees just to build up shields to not use against each other. And further, what typically happens is this hurts the small companies. Why? Because two big companies, let's say Dell and HP, you know, if one of them sues the other, you know what they're going to do? They're going to assert patents back against each other, and they're going to have a settlement. And you know what the settlement means? They're going to have a license with each other. They're going to cross-license to each other their patents. So each one gets to keep doing what they were doing with the fear of being sued by the other big guy gone now. What about little guys? They have no patents they can defend themselves with, so they're vulnerable. So this creates barriers to entry. So basically, copyrights don't help small authors and small creators, and patents don't help small independent inventors or small companies. They're basically huge waste on society. And as I said, there are all kind of creative things people are coming up with now to make money in the face of scarcity and non-scarce ideas. And this is not a new thing. Let me give you one illustrative example that always has caught my my mind. You're familiar with drive-in theaters, and they're not that common anymore, but they used to be popular. In the beginning, they had a big movie screen with speakers. Now, what happened? You had free riders. You had people that would sit on the neighboring hillsides or roads and watch the movie for free. So what did the owners do? They installed these little speakers on a per-car basis, right, which sound crappy and which cost them money to install. Now, why did they do this? They did this to exclude free riders. Now, they're entrepreneurs. They were creative. They thought of a way to overcome a free rider problem to try to calculate, to try to capture profits from customers. And they did a calculation. Is this worth it to me or not? If it had cost $1 million to put these speakers in, they wouldn't have done it. It wouldn't have been worthwhile. But they did. And that's just a typical example of the fact that almost every business faces cost of exclusion. Right, you have to have.
Well, now they go a little AM radio signal or FM, and they can do it. But I understand your point. There's always an innovative solution, but we just would have a different society with a different way of thinking. Let's go ahead and go to Scott from Cheyenne, Wyoming. He has a way of thinking, I'm sure. Go ahead and share it with us, Scott.
Oh, hi, Ernie. Yeah, you know, a lot of this discussion sounds like, well, you know, government screws things up and screws up everything they does, film at 11. But, I, you know, I've been following Stefan's arguments online for a bit, and I've been listening to the debates, and what it seems like it comes down to is Stefan is saying that people that make physical things, whether it's a unique item or if it's a mass-produced something that sells inexpensively to a lot of different people, deserve to be able to control the disposition of what they make. The people that make intellectual things or ideas or like art or music or whatever, once they share it with the first person, they completely lose control of it. And I don't see the justice in that.
Okay, so I would respond to that, that's a way of restating the fact that there's only property rights in scarce things. I mean, this is the way...
Well, that's an argument by definition, isn't it? You basically defined intellectual property out of property.
Well,
taking one very narrow view of what property is.
Well, but IP is not property in scarce things. It is property rights in non-scarce things. And as a matter of fact, in the world of tangible things, whenever we have a dispute, whenever we have a lawsuit, whenever we have a fight, it always comes down to real things. For example, let's say you and I have a dispute over a tract of land. The winner
right.
is going to get the right to control that piece of land. Or if you trespass against my house and I sue you and I win, you have to turn over to me physical money. Or maybe I get to punish you, okay? So that's control of your body. It always comes down to control of physical things. Now, the people who advocate that, you know, non-tangible things are just as real property as tangible things, like your argument implicitly presumes, you notice they never want to enforce their intangible rights in the intangible realm. They always want to enforce it in the real world. So, for example, if I infringe your copyright in your song, what do you want from me? You want money, which is a physical thing, or you want the court to issue a threat of physical force against my body or my property to stop me from doing something in the real physical world. Now, why is it that...
Well, as if there is no connection between the intellectual things and the physical things. I mean, I have to use my mind, which exists, and my brain, which is a physical thing, in order to create this intangible property. And then if my effort is and my work is disrespected by people taking it without compensating me for it, then yeah, the connection is already there between the physical and the intangible. And when I want a tangible compensation, it's because my tangible labor and my tangible mind has been ripped off.
Yeah, and I understand your concern, but to me, what you're saying is you're not quite sure how, in a world that only protected real property rights, how you could make money off of intangible things.
But that's part of it, but not the whole thing. There's also a matter of respecting the originator of something.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
Sometimes people take a copyright in things not because they want to be able to make money from it, but because they want to prevent it from being used in ways that they would find appalling. Newspapers will copyright their articles not because they want to be the only ones to sell them, but because they want to prevent politicians from using them in their campaign material in cases where the politicians are someone that the newspaper opposes and embarrasses the newspaper.
Well, that's a little bit confused. You're confusing trademark and copyright, which I'm not blaming you for, and in fact, this is part of the problem with IP laws. It's extremely arcane, confusing to layman, but look, let me tackle this. You said something about you create something. Well, that's a little bit begging the question, because in reality, what do we do as humans? We find scarce resources in the world, and then we manipulate them or we rearrange them to make them more valuable to us, right? It's not like we inject some value in them and they become intrinsically more valuable with some extra value quantity added into them. All you do is you take a block of marble and you manipulate it, and you make it more valuable to you or maybe to someone you want to give it to or sell it to, right?
Let's go
ahead and finish. We're not going to finish this before they push the button on us. So, Scott, can you hold on for a little bit?
Sure.
Okay, let's go ahead and hold Scott from Cheyenne, Wyoming. I mean, he's going to hold on for this a little bit. We got Stefan Kinsella on. Stefan, can you do another final segment with me? Stefan, can you?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, good. We'll get this finished when we come back.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
It's a peaceful, easy feeling. We're gonna get to the bottom of this thing. We're going to find out, I don't know, what can we advocate? You know, I'm always advocating for freedom. We just got to find out what that is. I mean, a lot of times it's really simple. It's really easy. But we've been brainwashed over, I guess, centuries into this idea that we can take an idea and patent it, that we can limit the innovation and creativity and the building on top of other people's concepts and ideas and innovations, that by protecting that, have we really done ourselves a favor? But we have Scott from Wyoming's going, look, man, hey, let me tell you what's tangible. It's me doing it. That's what's tangible. I did it. And now what? And Stefan was responding to that, and I want to give you an opportunity to finish your thought. Go ahead, Stefan.
Well, I mean, I would say this. Look, if you want to talk about an actual practical sort of reasonable reform, number one, it would be to realize that we have rights to freedom of press, for example, because there are property rights respected in our property, right? So the fundamental thing is to respect property rights and then let people do what they want with their property. And the other thing is, as a consequence of that, to respect contract rights and enforce contracts. And if people want to come up with contracts that somehow limit the information related to objects that they sell to their customers, more power to them. They can use DRM, they can use contracts, and we should start enforcing contracts. We should stop saying contracts shouldn't be enforced because of it's economic coercion or it's a contract of adhesion, which is a flypaper contract, things like this. If you enforce property rights, okay, and let's think about patents for a second. One of the reasons for patents is that we need them for pharmaceuticals, for example. Now, why do you need that? Well, to give more money to the pharmaceutical companies. Why do they need more money? Well, because they're taxed at a huge rate, they're subjected to huge regulations, and the FDA process itself saps their money and their resources. Why don't we talk about the federal government stopping the FDA process, stopping the regulations, stopping the taxes? And then we can stop relying on the federal government to come in as the white horse rescuer to give you a little bone of some kind of patent privilege to make up a little bit for all the damage it's doing to you in the first place. I mean, it's ridiculous for people to count on the the government are almost cursed. You know, this is it's an evil, evil, wicked thing, this government. Okay? You cannot count on the government to protect your rights. The government is the demon, the destroyer of our rights.
Well, I can get Scott to give an amen to that, but let me ask you, Scott, if the trade-off was that you did away with a lot of this government, in addition to this protection of intellectual property rights and patents and copyrights and trademarks and blah, 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 you get rid of that. Well, in addition to that, you get rid of all the regulation and licensing and the taxes and all that. Would that be a fair trade-off for you? You'd be okay with that?
Well,
because to protect your intellectual property rights, you have to have the government to do it. I mean, you're going, I want, as a libertarian, government to...
I think that if private property could be protected without a state, then intellectual property should be able to be protected without a state. I can't say exactly how that would be done.
Exactly.
But, you know, that's a matter for entrepreneurs in the marketplace for law to work out.
Well,
to borrow
arguments. Scott, do you think it's even conceivable that the Americans with Disabilities Act could possibly arise on a free market? I mean, look, these are
something roughly approximating it could.
Yeah, no, I had a restaurant.
Depending on how the way judges rule on certain kinds of
Well, irregardless of judges, I had a restaurant, and you know, I had all kinds of requirements of how big the bathroom's going to be, and how many grab bars you had, and how much you had, and this and that, and you know, on and on and on and on and on. And a lot of these things are addressed, you know, in the free market by, you know, what kind of customers do I want? You know, how many different types of diverse population do I want to get their money, you know, in order to thrive and survive in the business environment? I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, incentives for me to do different things. You go, come eat pizza here. Your wheelchair can fit. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, blacks are welcome. Or I say, you know, it's a property right. And only black people with blue eyes and wearing sidearms can come to my barbershop. I mean, you know, I can do whatever I want. And then
The way this could be handled is through the concept of fraud. If you're saying we're open to the public, everyone welcome, well, then you better be able to accommodate everyone that wants to come in. If you don't want to accommodate everyone, well, then you put up a sign that says cripples not accepted or blacks not accepted or whoever you don't want to accommodate, and then you don't have a problem.
But, Scott, that's not permitted by the law, so you cannot...
Well, not current law, no. We're talking about how an anarchist law would work.
You could not have the ADA... without the government intervention. You couldn't have it. No, I don't deny that you could have some version of IP law in terms of fraud law and contract law, but it's radically limited in scope, and it's not the same thing as what we have now. And by the way, you notice, I mean, I'm not picking on you, Scott, but Scott's hesitation at your question about the trade-off there, Ernest. And in fact,
I had to think about what he was asking me.
Yeah.
Well,
my
point is that you have a to protect intellectual property rights, you have to beg the question, who's going to be protecting it?
You have to have a state, and not only that, Ernest. If you think about it, by the logic of IP, okay. Now let's take the Randians, right? The Ayn Rand types who believe in a minimal government, right? And they always struggle with the idea of trying to justify how we can tax people. And Ayn Rand could never find a way to justify taxation, but she wasn't for anarchy either, right? Well, but she also believed in IP. And if you believe in IP and you worship the original Constitution like she did, you could easily simply say, well, that's a benefit to humanity. It was a creative, innovative governmental design. The government is giving, you know, is entitled to collect a royalty for this. Why not call that a tax? So in other words, IP justifies the state. And you have to have a state to have IP.
Ouch.
Well, then you could also argue you have to have a state to have property. I mean, we don't argue that way. You know, we in the libertarian camp, we argue that property rights predate the state. And
property rights do predate the state.
Right.
Roads predate the state. Law predates the state. Morals predate
the
state.
Well, slavery predates the state, too, and we got rid of it. I mean, just because something has been you know, with us some time immemorial doesn't mean it's right. We do have progress in civilization, at least along some fronts.
No.
And one of those is that we don't allow ownership of people anymore.
Well, of course you
can. Now just because intellectual property rights have not been respected in the state's slapdash, ham-handed, haphazard way for only the last 150 years, that in itself doesn't mean they're not valid.
Well, let me say this. When I talk to IP advocates, of libertarian advocates of IP, I can point out, I could point out literally 100 things right now that I'm sure you would agree with me. I'm not in favor of that. I'm not in favor of that. And so I do this all the time. I talk to these IP guys, these IP advocates, and I keep saying, well, here's the problem with it. Here's the problem with it. And they say, well, I'm not in favor of the current system. And yet they're opposing my call to abolish the current system. So that means they are in favor of it.
No, you're calling for more than abolishing this current system. You're calling into question the whole idea that there can be intellectual property.
That's correct.
That's much more fundamental than what sort of institutions we ought to have to enforce laws.
That's correct. But then when I ask someone like you, I say, well, you're against A, B, C, D, E, F, G, everything I'm against.
Yeah.
What are you in favor of? Then the answer is, well, I'm not an IP expert. I don't know.
That's kind of like when we ask, well, if we don't have IP, how are we going to be able to make a living? You say, well, that's not my problem. That's for you to figure out.
And that's the answer. It's not my problem. That's the entrepreneur's problem. I mean, it's like a communist asking how many forms of toothpaste would there be in a free market. I don't know. Let's wait. Let's let it settle out and see. But when I hear like the previous caller say we should have a improve the patent system, to my ears, it's just like the tax reformist who says, well, we should go to a flat tax system or a national sales tax or a value-added tax. I mean, all this bullshit where, you know, the truth is we want no tax. We want to lower the tax rates.
It is my obligation as host on a FCC network that's controlled by the government to say, you said naughty trash can word, and you're not supposed to do that. So there, I'm covered. You're confusing me with someone that cares.
Change.
My point is, look, we cannot reform this around the edges. This is a government bureaucracy. It's a cash cow for the government. It is used for censorship, for oppression, and it is even being used in Russia. By the way, the recent story, Microsoft was cooperating with the Russian government to use IP law, patent law, to investigate political opponents of the regime. I mean, this is just par for the course. This is nothing but a government tool to control people and to give money, to transfer money to special interests of the state.
Everyone does bad things. That's nothing new, but you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Well, yeah. If it's Rosemary's baby, let it go, you know. That's Barry Hess's thing. I've heard him say that before. You know, the thing that I really, at the fundamental part, I know who this is. Scott Beezer, right?
Yeah.
Scott Beezer is a commercial graphic artist that does a great, in fact, he's the one that designed the Freedom's Phoenix bird logo that we have, and he does a great job, and I had you in mind when I had Stefan come on, because I know that, you know, authors and artists such as you count on the intellectual property to be able to sustain a lot of it, what it is that you hold dear, which is your creation. You know, I understand this, but I'm really trying to get to a fundamental basis. Is that okay? What's the fundamental thing that we want government doing, if you're going to have one at all? Protection of property rights, and then in this concept of intellectual property, I'm still formulating it, but I kind of lean in towards, if I can patent, if I can control an idea, an innovation, that makes me very powerful, and powerful guys that control me get theirs. I understand. It's a good issue. We'll be talking about it more. Stefan, thanks for coming on. We'll see you tomorrow.